Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Wednesday, March 3rd. When Joe Biden was inaugurated 6 weeks ago yesterday, he listed four main priorities for his administration: the pandemic, the economy, climate change, and racial injustice. On the latter, he said this just a few days later.
Those 8 minutes and 46 seconds that took George Floyd's life opened the eyes of millions of Americans and millions of people around all over the world. It was the knee on the neck of justice, and it wouldn't be forgotten.
Yes, he promised to weave equity and justice into the fabric of the whole of government, not just certain agencies. A few minutes later, in the same address, he said this.
I believe this nation and this government need to change their whole approach to the issue of racial equity.
Change their whole approach. A big promise on an ongoing 400-year-old issue. A few days later, Georgetown law professor and racial justice advocate Paul Butler cited those quotes in a Washington Post op-ed that was kind of a first-week report card for Biden on the topic. It was called, On Racial Justice, Biden is off to a decent start. Let's hope it keeps up. So we've invited Paul Butler to come on with us a few times over the next few months with his take on how much Biden is keeping it up as a way of not letting racial justice conveniently fall by the wayside as other demands and other politics arise. We'll also touch today on how the big lie of the stolen election might now be resulting in new limits on Black Americans' voting rights, given Republican power in state legislatures and the courts. Again, Paul Butler is a Georgetown law professor. He's also a former federal prosecutor. He's a Washington Post contributing opinion writer and author of the book, Chokehold, Policing Black Men. Hi, Paul. We appreciate you doing this with us. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hey, Brian. It's great to be here.
And to set the stage, the first line of your op-ed on January 28th was that Biden was starting out on racial justice as more ambitious than President Obama ever was or felt he could be. Would you lay out that basic premise for us?
He's got more space than Obama ever felt like he had. President Obama famously said that he couldn't pass laws that say I'm just helping Black folks. And Obama mainly relied on a colorblind approach to advance racial justice. He would always say that a rising tide lifts all boats. The problem is that many Black folks and Native American folks never had a vote to begin with. But Biden isn't saddled with Obama's concerns about not wanting to favor African Americans or look like he is. So in his victory speech, Biden told African American voters, you've always had my back and I'll have yours. He was the first president to say white supremacy in an inaugural address. And as you've indicated, he said that that racist ideology is one that we have to confront and we have to defeat. So he's more ambitious than President Obama was or felt like he could be. And the expectations are correspondingly extremely high.
So in January, you wrote, Biden is off to a credible start, first by undoing some of Trump's most egregious policies on race. Want to remind us of what some of those things from Trump were that Biden undid early on?
So President Trump had established a 1776 commission, which encouraged schools to teach U.S. history, discounting the role of white supremacy. On his first day, President Biden rolled that back. President Biden ordered the Department of Housing and Urban Development to beef up its anti-discrimination enforcement, which had lagged under the Trump administration. President Obama had banned private federal prisons. Trump reinstated them. And now Biden has reimposed the ban. So I think about that HBO show that I watched earlier this year, The Undoing, it was called. And that's kind of how Biden has started with regard to racial justice. He's undone a lot of the harmful policies that President Trump put in place.
So, Paul, now that you got that pop culture reference in, I'm going to ask you an open-ended question. Do you have any headlines on what he's done since?
Brian, we have to appreciate the arc of this man's journey with regard to racial justice. For most of his long career, Biden has been, I think, a profoundly decent man. But for most of that very long career, he has not been a leader on race. And indeed, sometimes his political ambition has veered him off course, as when he opposed busing to achieve school integration. Kamala Harris famously reminded him of that in a debate where they were competing against each other for the Democratic nomination. And Biden used to brag about his role in passing the 1994 crime bill, which we now understand is a leading cause of mass incarceration and race disparity. So to go from that to being the first president to talk about systemic racism, and as he did a couple of weeks ago, to say that white supremacists are the greatest threat to our national security. Wow, has he come a long way. Would that this country and would that most white folks could emulate that journey. So he started out that first week really well. I said at the piece, in the piece, another reference to pop culture, the question should always be, what have you done for us lately? That's Janet Jackson. And when we think, okay, the undoing was the first week, what's next? So we had, of course, the Senate impeachment trial. And the president, I think, appropriately has been focused on his appointments and also defeating the pandemic. And we know that all of those have profound racial consequences. And so I haven't seen as much of specific attention on racial justice, but I'll give him not so much a pass as a couple more weeks, let's say. So we know that Merrick Garland is likely to be confirmed as Attorney General this week. Garland is another person who's kind of hard to read in terms of his leadership on racial justice as a federal judge. That hasn't been part of his portfolio. Mm-hmm. But we also know that he led the prosecution of the Oklahoma City bomber. And he's said that when he's confirmed, if he's confirmed, that he'll make understanding what happened on January 6th a priority, his first line of business. And we know that that was all about white supremacy. But we know that that kind of domestic terrorism creates a major threat to the safety and well-being of people of color. And so even though he hasn't explicitly been focused on race, I think I'm willing to give him a little bit more time.
Let's take a phone call. Mary in Union County, you're on WNYC. Hi, Mary.
Yeah, hi, good morning. Nice to talk to you and Mr. Butler. I would like to see Biden get rid of the filibuster. I like for the Democrats to have some backbone, just like the Republicans. They don't give 2 cents about what you think about what they do. Get rid of the filibuster so he can move his plan ahead and go big. I think that will help the senators in the next election. And if I can throw this in about, maybe this is not the time to throw something in about Cuomo, but I like to see him stay in office. And I wish the Democrats would stop throwing the party under the bus. The Republicans don't do it, but the Democrats is always throwing their people under the bus. But Biden should go big, get rid of that filibuster later for that those Republicans, because they would do the same thing.
What do you
and
say?
And pass the 15. Uh-huh.
On Cuomo, just curious what you would say to some of our other callers who say the Republican Party won't, so the Democratic Party needs to be the one that does set a standard on the unacceptability of certain kinds of male boss behavior.
Well, what I saw last night when I think Cuomo, and I'm not no fan of Cuomo, but when I saw him, I think he was at a party. He put his hands on the girl's face. I don't know if he kissed her on the cheek or the lips. It was a friend of his wife. Listen, you know what? Like somebody said yesterday, you're young, you're attractive. It's a compliment. Get over it. If they're doing something that you feel uncomfortable with, there's nothing wrong with saying, I don't like that, I don't accept that. And if they do it again, then you can complain. Mm-hmm. But there's a way of saying, that's not me, I don't like it. And I think they'll appreciate it. Stop crying, these young girls crying. And this was something that happened back in 2019. It's a compliment when a guy look at you.
Yeah, Mary, thank you very much. She said these young girls, so more evidence that this is a generational divide on this, at least in part. But I don't want to get too sidetracked on, you know, either side of the Cuomo discussion right now, but it was interesting that that Mary brought it up. But to her main point, at least one main policy point that she brought up, Paul, do you see the filibuster as a racial equity or racial justice issue?
Indeed, I do. We know that its history is that it's been deployed by white supremacists to exclude people of color and especially African Americans from the ballot box. It's been used to try to prevent civil rights bills like the Voting Rights Act, the most successful civil rights bill of all time. I think the comparison that the caller made to Governor Cuomo is instructive in some ways. So I'm not thinking about the sexual harassment allegations, but looking at Governor Cuomo as kind of a traditional white Democrat, and he's progressive on some issues, but on a lot of racial justice issues, and especially on criminal justice, he's not progressive. So, for example, he's not been supportive of bail reform laws in the state, not as supportive as he should have been. And with regard to the dire problem of the pandemic in state prisons in New York, he's been behind the curve. So in that sense, he's not been all that different from a lot of other white, democratic, progressive leaders. And so what's different about President Biden is this sense that he's going to go bold. And that sense comes from statements that he's made, like the one that you played at the beginning, where he said, this nation and this government need to change their whole approach to the issue of racial equity. So that's not just having kumbaya moments on Martin Luther King or Black History Month. That's bold policy initiatives, things like ending the filibuster, supporting that, since he can't do that as president, but he could certainly support that move. One of the members of the squad, Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, said a couple of weeks ago that if President Biden really wants to go bold on race, he should cancel all student debt. And that would be a racial and gender justice intervention because African American women carry more of that debt than any other group.
It's a perfect example, I think, of a policy that, or a policy area that many people, especially many white people, might think of as sort of race neutral? Cancel student debt, because we think of the whole generation that's saddled with student debt. But when you scratch below the surface, it's disproportionate. And so it becomes a racial equity issue, right?
Everything becomes a racial equity issue. And I think that President Biden gets that. So, for example, if we think about climate change, Gina McCarthy, who's his national advisor on that issue, says that that's a racial justice issue. It's a racial justice issue because it exacerbates challenges in communities that have already been left behind. And we know that in terms of environmental justice, that communities that disproportionately suffer pollution and poisoning from chemical sources are often communities of color. And so Biden isn't going to just have the Justice Department be part of his anti-racism initiatives. His plan is to embed anti-racism in every single government agency.
Charles in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Paul Butler. Hi, Charles.
Hey, Brian, thank you so much. It's a great honor. And I'd like to say to your guest that, you know, I think Biden is the political rock star. I liked him back during Anita Hill. I think he's been prepared for this moment better than anyone. He worked under a black president. He's well prepared. And I think that he should create a task force to go after these white supremacists, because it's a poison that we allow to exist, just like the Ku Klux Klan. There's still a chapter of that. And I heard the other day on the news, they said in Germany, they're actually surveillance now white supremacists. They're tapping their emails, they're tapping their phone calls. And I think that we got to set an example, because this poison we let go created what happened on January 6th.
Charles, thank you very much. Paul, and we're going to run out of time soon, but how do you see the two things intersecting? Because in a way, tell me if you disagree, but sometimes I think when we talk about white supremacy, we're using the same phrase for two different things. One is the explicit white nationalists, like some of those who stormed the Capitol. And the other is what's baked in intentionally and often unintentionally to policy all the way down the line, kind of like we were talking about student debt. Status quo on student debt reinforces white supremacy in that whites come out with a supreme wealth and income. So how do you see the two things tying together if you accept the premise?
Yeah, I think that that's exactly right, Brian. So we can think of white supremacists as the Klan, the first domestic terrorist. And we used to think of that kind of explicit violent racism as something that was back in the day that we as a nation have overcome. And now, especially after January 6th, we see that that's clearly not the case, that violent white resistance to civil rights, to gender justice, to LGBT equality is still an important factor in U.S. politics. At the same time, when I think about the criminal legal process and policing issues, we have bad apple cops, so we can think of those as the equivalent of white supremacists. But we also have discrimination and anti-blackness baked in the system. So that's the systemic part. And there I've said the problem isn't only bad apple cops. The problem is the system is working the way it's supposed to. When we look at all of the protections for police officers who commit violence or selective arrest against people of color. And so both of those have to be part of this fight for racial justice. And If systemic discrimination is baked in, that means that it is part of the law. It's part of our policies. And so Biden's absolutely right when he says we have to rethink what government does and how it acts. So again, that's extremely creative. It's extremely ambitious. He's got his work cut out for him. And we're going to be watching extremely closely because the stakes are high. This isn't only about racial justice. This is about democracy. It's about the sustainability and future of the American experiment.
And we're happy that Paul Butler has agreed to come on with us a few times and monitor that progress. Paul Butler is a Georgetown law professor. He's also a Washington Post contributing columnist, former federal prosecutor, and author of the book, Chokehold, Policing Black Men. And you were here for a book interview, but I forgot the title for the moment. Chokehold, Policing Black Men. Paul, we appreciate it so much. Talk to you next time. Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.